Hello all, I'm the academic agent. George Orwell once said that so much of left-wing thought is kind of playing with fire by people who don't even know that fire is hot. I sometimes wonder if they know the reason that they're playing with fire at all. It's because their ultimate goal is burning down the house. In the words of David Byrne, watch out. You might get what you're after. It was also George Orwell who coined the term newspeak in his novel 1984. As you'll recall, of course, under Big Brother's regime, it was the totalitarian language created to meet the ideological requirements of English socialism. Newspeak is a controlled language of restricted grammar and limited vocabulary, a linguistic design meant to limit the freedom of thought, personal identity, self-expression, free will, that ideologically threatens the regime of Big Brother and the party, who thus criminalise such concepts as thought crime, contradictions of Ingsoc orthodoxy. Now in this video, I want to explore the various ways in which the political left have continually used this technique in the real world, in both Britain and in the USA, since at least the 1960s. Now you might think that this is a recent phenomenon coinciding with the rise of the modern day social justice warrior, but alas, the left have always done this. And it is not a new observation. Many conservative commentators have pointed it out over the years, and I will be drawing from some of them here. It just so happens that I have been reading some of this stuff recently, and I wanted to share it with you. First up, here is the philosopher Roger Scruton in his marvellous book, Fools, Frauds and Firebrands, Thinkers of the New Left, which I think sets up this topic nicely. Ordinary language warms and softens. Newspeak freezes and hardens. An ordinary discourse generates out of its own resources the concepts that newspeak forbids. Fair, unfair, just, unjust, right, duty, honest, dishonest, legal, illegal, yours, mine. Such distinctions, which belong to the free exchange of feelings, opinions, and goods, also when freely expressed and acted upon, create a society in which order is spontaneous and not planned, and in which the unequal distribution of assets arises by an invisible hand. Newspeak does not merely impose a plan, it also eliminates the discourse through which human beings can live without one. If justice is referred to in newspeak, it is not the justice of individual dealings, but social justice, the kind of justice imposed by a plan, which invariably involves depriving individuals of things they have acquired by fair dealing in the market. In the opinion of almost all thinkers who I discuss in what follows, government is the act of seizing and then redistributing the things to which all citizens are supposedly entitled. It is not the expression of a pre-existing social order shaped by our free agreements and our natural disposition to hold ourselves and our neighbours to account. It is the creator and manager of a social order framed according to an idea of social justice and imposed on the people by a series of top-down decrees. Intellectuals are naturally attracted by the idea of a planned society in the belief that they will be in charge of it. In this way, it seems to me it is not an accident that the triumph of leftist ways of thinking has so often led to totalitarian government. The pursuit of abstract social justice goes hand in hand with the view that power struggles and relations of domination express the truth of our social condition, and that the consensual customs, inherited institutions and systems of law that have brought peace to real communities are merely the disguises worn by power. The goal is to seize that power and to use it to liberate the oppressed, distributing all the assets of society according to the just requirements of the plan. Intellectuals who think that way are already rooting out the possibility of compromise. Their totalitarian language does not set out a path of negotiation, but instead divides human beings into innocent and guilty groups, behind the impassioned rhetoric of the Communist Manifesto, behind the pseudoscience of Marx's labour theory of value, and behind the class analysis of human history, lies a single emotional source: resentment of those who control things. This resentment is both rationalized and amplified by the proof that property owners form a class. According to the theory, the bourgeois class has a shared moral identity, a shared and systematic access to the levers of power, and a shared body of privileges. Moreover, all those good things are acquired and retained through the exploitation of the proletariat, which has nothing to part with except its labour, and which will therefore always be cheated of its just deserts. Now, to illustrate the fact that the left did not just do this in Soviet Russia, but they're doing it here and now, here is Matt Ridley writing in the Times back in July of this year. It feels as if the left has always been better at vocabulary than the right. Capitalism was a word largely invented by the opponents of commerce. The socialist Louis Blanc first used it in its modern sense in 1850, defining it as the appropriation of capital by some to the exclusion of others. Marx and Engels then made it a proper boo word. Ever since, the left has used capitalism to imply that all free market commerce is run by big financiers, with massive investments rather than merchants and entrepreneurs taking risks on behalf of consumers and driving down prices. For reasons I don't fully understand, the champions of commerce fell in with this scheme and have spent the last century and a half trying to defend the word capitalism instead of commerce or enterprise. Then again, even the market has been successfully tarnished as a word. By allowing this term to represent free exchange between individuals, liberals have appeared to concede that there is a monolithic authority over and against the individual. Yet, paraphrasing Margaret Thatcher, there is no such thing as the market. There are individual men and women and their families, all of them making goods, providing services, and exchanging them with other individuals and willing buyers and sellers. Likewise, the term Tory for a conservative is generally intended as an insult, as is the term socialist for the Labour person. It remains a puzzle why we have never coined a noun for Labour members. But note that a diligently impartial newscaster on, say, Channel 4 will not hesitate to use Tory Prime Minister to describe Theresa May, but would never call Jeremy Corbyn the socialist leader of the opposition. Now, why is that? Indeed, the right often seems resigned to adopting the vocabulary of the left. Words such as capitalism, Tory, poll tax. The current success of the word austerity seems to stem from a too successful decision by George Osborne to be honest about the public finances in 2010. Greens are into this too. Who redefined renewables as clean energy? The propagandists have been so relentless in its use that most journalists have now stopped putting quotation marks around it. They went along with the rebadging of global warming as climate change to sound less mild and to take credit for blizzards as well as heat waves. Then there is Islamic vocabulary. According to Azra Noumani, writing in the Washington Post in 2015, there was a deliberate policy decision by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation to begin trying to control the debate on Islam. This wider corpse throws the label of Islamophobe on pundits, journalists, and others who dare to talk about extremist ideology in the religion. The insults may look similar to internet trolling and vitriolic comments you can find on any blog or news site, but they're more coordinated, frightening, and persistent. And if true, this deserves more coverage. Now, there is no shortage of examples of any of this that we might draw from. In one of my favourite books, The Vision of the Anointed, Thomas Sowell devotes a whole chapter to exposing the verbal games and verbal virtuosity of the left. I won't read it all out here, but rather I will pick out a few of my favourite illustrative examples. He says, in light of the underlying assumptions of the prevailing vision, it may be easier to see why the particular vocabulary used by the United is what it is. The swirl of their buzzwords, access, stigma, progressive, diversity, crisis, etc., shows a discernible pattern. What these innumerable buzzwords have in common is that they either 1. Preempt issues rather than debate them, 2. Set the anointed and the benighted on different moral and intellectual planes, or 3. Evade the issue of personal responsibility. So let's have a look at the first one then, and that is crisis. He says, the word crisis, for example, is a preemptive word used for its prospective political effect rather than for its contemporary or retrospective accuracy. When the anointed say that there is a crisis, this means that something must be done, and it must be done simply because the anointed want it done. This word becomes one of many substitutes for evidence or logic. So do words like genuine need, or self-contradictory phrases like people living below subsistence. Now, this is another example of newspeak from Sowell. He says, one of the never-ending crusades of the anointed is for more public service. Like so many of the special buzzwords of the anointed, this phrase does not mean what the straightforward sense of the word seems to say. Not every service to the public is a public service in this newspeak. For example, those who deliver tons of life-sustaining food to supermarkets are not engaged in public service, as the anointed used the term. Neither are those who build a roof over people's heads or produce the clothes on people's backs. Those who perform those vital services are activated by the incentives of the marketplace, perhaps even by greed, another fashionable buzzword that puts the anointed and the benighted on different moral planes. The call for more public service is then a call for more people to work in jobs not representing the preferences of the public as revealed through the marketplace, but the preferences of third parties enforced through government and paid for by the power of taxation. Sometimes work for foundations and other non-profit organizations is also included in public service. What is crucial is that public service not be service defined by the public itself through its choices of how to spend its own money in market transactions, but defined for them by third-party elites. Otherwise, the most valuable and even life-saving activities are not worthy of the benediction public service, while making oneself a nuisance to other people with door-to-door solicitations in an activity worthy of that verbal aura, when it is in a cause favoured by the anointed. Forcing the public to pay for art calculatingly insulting to the public sensibilities is also a public service, as the anointed define the term, and a failure to pay is censorship in this same lexicon, regardless of how free those artists remain to produce and sell their products to those willing to pay with their own money. Imagine how Paul Joseph Watson would feel about that one. What is crucial about the concept of public service as used by the anointed is that it must be defined by third parties and not by the public itself. So this is another example from Sowell. He talks about access. Now, people are often said to lack access to various jobs, educational institutions, or credit, when in fact they may not have behaved or performed in a way that would enable them to meet the same standards that others meet. Access is just one of a number of ex ante expressions, opportunity, bias, and glass ceiling, for example, are used to describe ex post results in such a way as to preempt the whole question as to why those results turned out the way they did. If a job ceiling is glass, for example, that says it is invisible, and the assertion must be accepted without evidence. Implicit in much of this verbiage is the notion that the rules were rigged for or against some individual group. But whether or to what extent this is true is precisely the issue that should be argued, not circumvented by a verbal sleight of hand. And indeed, this has happened here in Britain just in this past week. The Guardian has been running wild with a claim that only 3% of the top 1,000 most powerful jobs in the FTSE 100 are occupied by so-called BAME people. Where did that phrase BAME come from all of a sudden? Incidentally, it means black, Asian, and minority ethnic. Anyway, as if to prove Sowell's point in real time, they make all of these arguments, and that 3% number doesn't look right to these Guardian journalists. So they think it's a crisis, it's shocking, we must urgently act to fix this terrible problem. But of course, no one ever asks why. For example, 70% of NFL stars are black, when only 12.7% of the US population are black, or why only 37% of British doctors are white, when over 90% of the British population is white. As it happens, British Indians and Asians massively over-index in that field, even though they make up precisely 0% of the national football team, which is over 80% black, over 10 times the national percentage of black people. Now, such statistics are not what our Guardian journalists are looking for, which is what makes them so maddeningly dishonest. If their quest for cosmic justice was a real thing, they'd be wondering why the percentages in those industries don't exactly mirror the national demographic averages. But of course, this quest only works in one direction and only has one purpose. Another great example from Sowell is the way that the left talks about progress. A whole family of self-flattering words serves as benedictions for the vision of the anointed. Progress and progressive are prominent examples. But everyone is for progress by definition. They differ only on specifics, though these differences may be extreme and even violent. Words like progress or progressive preempt these specific issues by arbitrarily assuming the differential desirability of one's own preferred changes without having to debate substance or even acknowledge its relevance. And elsewhere, and this is one of my favourite bits of this book, he says, perhaps the purest example of an argument without an argument is to say that something is inevitable. This is an inherently irrefutable argument as long as any time remains in the future. Only in the last fraction of a second of the existence of the universe could anyone refute that claim, and perhaps they would have other things on their mind by then. And I've actually come across this in my own YouTube adventures when I've been debating with various communists and Marxists who, you know, think that the end of capitalism is inevitable, and then we get into some sort of science fiction debate. Anyway, whether particular policies are favoured or opposed, there are opaque proclamations of this sort which substitute for arguments. And whether a policy is favoured or opposed, it may be currently existing or non-existent. In each of these four cases, there are proclamations that substitute for arguments, as illustrated in this table. Now have a look at this. If the left favour something and it already exists, then it's here to stay. And if it doesn't exist, they argue that it is inevitable that it will come to be. But if they oppose a particular policy and it already exists, they decry it as being outmoded. And if it doesn't exist, and it's, let's say, a plan the Tories want to bring in or the Republicans, it is dismissed as being unrealistic. It is one of the signs of our times that such proclamations are so widely accepted in view of arguments, but only when used in support of the prevailing vision of the anointed. I'll stop there. In short, the left's entire rhetorical strategy is to argue entirely without reason or evidence through these verbal games, and it is designed to appeal to emotion. Sowell actually lists these strategies. I've just typed up a few of them here. Verbal preemption, that's this tactic of basically prejudging something before you even come to debate it. The second one is disdaining the benighted. That's basically Hillary calling all of Trump's supporters deplorables. You know, you're well familiar with the practice of disdaining the benighted. You know, the opponents of the left are either stupid or racist or, you know, uneducated or hicks or whatever phrases they want to use. There's also this question of feasibility. And you'll see this a lot when Jeremy Corbyn is debating. They always speak in terms of their goals or the outcomes they want to achieve, never in terms of the specifics of how they're actually going to achieve them, never in terms of the actual process. And, you know, Labour are maddeningly difficult to pin down on these things. You also see it over in America as well. You know, Bernie Sanders is a couple of weeks ago had that whole speech about how he wants to launch single-payer universal healthcare, but so vague on how he was actually going to achieve it. Then there's the cosmic viewpoint. That is the quest for cosmic justice that I was talking about, this idea that we're going to somehow achieve universal equality, that you know, national demographics are going to somehow line up exactly with all of the percentages of people within various different industries. You know, 50% of women are going to be computer programmers, etc., etc. Then there is, of course, naming names, this tactic of labeling. That is what Matt Ridley was talking about in the Times, really, with you know, how capitalism or Tory, that these are insulting labels. In fact, the right in general is a kind of preemptive insult. And then there is, of course, verbal inflation. And this is a tactic that you're all familiar with, where a given word or a given area keeps on expanding way beyond its normal definition. For example, violence is one of the ones that Sowell talks about, how words are now violent. Or how about rape? That's another one where the definition of what counts as rape keeps on expanding. And again, all of you here on Sargon's channel will know about that. Now, what are we going to do about this? I think Ben Shapiro has the right idea. You must systematically deny the left all of this turf if you're ever in a political discussion with them. Redefine all of their buzzwords in plain English. Insist on defining it in the way that makes it abundantly clear what they actually mean, because the word in question will undoubtedly obscure the true meaning of what their intentions are. For example, if they are complaining about the shocking fact that some particular group isn't represented in some particular job, ask them directly why they expect to see national demographics mirrored in particular industries. Hit them with the stats I mentioned earlier on. Ask them why they aren't concerned that only 37% of doctors are white when 90% of people are white in this country. Put them on the back foot. Force them into revealing their true intentions. Deny them any form of moral high ground. When they say things which preemptively attack you, preemptively attack them. And here in the UK, when we have a sneering, virtue-signalling socialist twat like Jeremy Corbyn, the absolute boy, oh, Jeremy Corbyn, on the rise, this has never, ever been more important. They want to paint their opponents as evil. Make no mistake, they are totalitarians, and we need to do everything possible to combat them at this time. If you've made it this far, thank you for watching. I am the Academic Agent. Come along to my YouTube channel where I encourage you to subscribe, watch a few videos, leave a few comments. We have some lively discussions over there. And if you want to talk to me even more, I am also on Twitter @AcademicAgent. So long for now.